Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
This is Bio 241, and it's Thursday, the 5th of February. And we just had a nice announcement from Free, who's over there in the LLRC. If you check the syllabus, I'm sure I have the telephone number of the LLRC in the syllabus even. So you can just call over there ahead of time to make an appointment. And they might even let you know if there's no time left. Okay, another question. Let's check it out. Let's check this out. Where is it? Supplemental instruction.
Yeah.
Sorry, we don't have supplemental instruction this semester. Sorry about that. Okay. Yeah, it took me a while to upgrade that little button right there. Okay. If it changes, I'll let you know. Okay. All right, one thing before we get started, I'm going to look at the schedule, but I also want to go to weekly assignments. Here's just the week one. They've all been reprogrammed so that you can see your answers. Oh, you can't see it. How nasty is that? Well, why is that? Because the off button is pushed. That's what, there's always some button something. You know, if they were just dials, I could do it. I didn't grow up with buttons. Okay, so it's coming online. So I can just talk to you. So all the quizzes have been reprogrammed so that you can take them and you'll see the results, right? Yeah, I had it programmed. I thought it would be really nice and easy. I had it open up in a different window than what Blackboard that you clicked in, but it just doesn't work with the browsers anymore. So anyhow, so you just get it in the same window. But at least you can follow what's going on. Okay, it is appearing. Here is something that's really important. And I'm not sure how I have it. I didn't take time to look. But here you have these online practice quizzes. And some of these questions will end up on the exam, just like end of chapter questions. And so you make sure that in the study guide, and maybe I forgot to put it in the study guide, that these questions here are important for you to study for the exam. Yeah.
Now, I noticed that some of them have, like, different editions of the book.
Uh-huh. No, these right here. And the edition that you have, 12, is no longer online. It disappeared. That was a real hassle last semester. Just went away unexpectedly. And that's because the publisher of this textbook hired, outsourced those questions, and then when they lost the contract with that outsourcer, then they lost everything that they put on. Okay. All right, so make sure your study guides include this information. Okay. And indeed, there are two different editions of the textbook. Sometimes the questions are identical. Sometimes they're reworded a little bit differently. And so you got to go over both of these. And even sometimes there's going to be a question in here, right? And it's going to be the exact same question, but it will have different answers. So that seems nasty, but that just means you have to think about that one even more. I really like the question, but there's something wrong with the question. There's something wrong with the answers. And it's an important topic that you should be able to think about and kind of rationalize which way the question should go, which way the answer should go. And I'd be happy to talk to you about it, okay? Because sometimes it's not exactly clear, but it's not just memorization that way. You really have to think about it. All right, what else? All the lectures are online. That's working. Here's the schedule. So we're on the 5th. We're going to finish up chemistry today, maybe move into chapter 6. And we have two lectures next week. Yeah, indeed we do. Two lectures next week. Oh, and even two lectures the week after that. And I guess the reason is we don't have a holiday on Monday, like the Monday-Wednesday classes. So we get two the week after that. So then we're going to cover chapter 3, and that's everything for the first exam, which you'll have on February 24th, and that's going to be on a Tuesday. So I see another exam on a Tuesday. That's what that color means. And then I would guess what? That the color changes for the last two exams. Yeah, for sure the last one can't be on a Tuesday. It's going to be on a Thursday. It's the last day of the semester. So here is another one on the 23rd of April that's on a Thursday. But you don't have any practicums in here, so that's not such a big issue. But that is a really big issue for anatomy, if you have a lecture exam and a practicum the same day. So nonetheless, I still kind of split it up. Okay, so these online practice quizzes, take them. And there's actually too many questions for you to memorize the answer. So you should have a really good understanding of the question. And I know some of these questions are kind of hard because when I read them, I have to think about what the answer is. All right, so if I have to think about it, I know you guys have to think about it too. So get an early start answering these questions, okay? Okay. And the exam figures in the study guide are important as well. Knowing those flow diagrams, they're not anatomy diagrams. They're really more conceptual diagrams, flow diagrams. They might be overlaid on some anatomy, but it's a little bit different than plain old anatomy diagrams. Okay, so last time we talked about how we build polymers. What the heck is a polymer? What's a polymer? Am I recording? Yeah, I think I'm recording. What's a polymer? I almost heard you. It's a molecule. Okay, what kind of molecule is it? It's a really nice simple molecule, even though it's really long. Think of it as a chain, right? When you have a chain, you have that repeating subunit over and over and over and over again. And so a polymer is just a chain of other building blocks, other molecules that have been joined together, and those basic building blocks. You know, you could have maybe 100 of those building blocks put together or thousands of them put together. How's that, too dark? Okay. Is that good? Okay. I always forget. So a polymer is, it has a basic building block. The building blocks can be a little bit different. Sometimes they're exactly the same. And the building blocks are put together. So what's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. That's right. So a protein is made by taking an amino acid and joining it with another one, and then another one, and another one, and another one. It just becomes a really long string of amino acids. That's what we call that primary structure. How would your body put amino acids together? What kind of chemical reaction would be used? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Yeah, how would your body take those amino acids apart? How would it digest? A hydrolysis reaction. Okay, that's pretty good. How would your body make a polysaccharide out of glucose? How would your body make a glycogen molecule? Because glycogen is a polymer of glucose. And that's it, just glucose. How does your body make glycogen? What kind of chemical reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction, exactly the same thing. And so how would your body chop a glucose molecule off of glycogen and put it into your blood if your blood glucose level starts to decrease? What kind of chemical reaction would your body use? Would be a hydrolysis, right? So it's just going to be that same kind of theme over and over and over again, and the same thing for triglycerides. And we're going to see the same thing for nucleic acids too. All right, so we got to know what the building block of these nucleic acids are. So let's start. I'm going to start the lecture, but if you have a question from last time, go ahead, raise your hand in just a second, and I'll see you raising your hand. Okay, now I am looking. Anybody have a question over what we talked about last time? We're good? All right, so I'm going to go to one-and-one projection right here at nucleic acid. So I said there's a number of classes of important biological molecules in our body. We've looked at sugars, we've looked at lipids, looked at proteins, right? And now we're going to look at this group right here. So if you're going to characterize those important biological molecules, how many classes are we going to break all those molecules down into? How many classes? Indeed, four. Right? Because we got what? We got lipids, sugars, proteins, nucleic acids. And that covers pretty much everything that we're going to be interested in, and your body can make polymers out of the building blocks of those compounds. Okay, so nucleic acids include both DNA and RNA, and you should know what these things stand for. It will help you understand the different structure involved. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, and then RNA just stands for plain old ribonucleic acid. So you could probably tell me the difference between DNA and RNA right now. Deoxyribonucleic acid is DNA. It is missing something. What is it missing? It's missing an oxygen atom. And we're going to see where that oxygen atom is, and that's why we call it deoxy. And ribose is going to be the sugar molecule. RNA has that oxygen in the one location. All right, so DNA and RNA made up of long chains of nucleotides. So what's the building block of a nucleic acid? A nucleotide. What's the building block of protein? Amino acid. What's the building block of a nucleic acid? Nucleotide. Yeah, so you got to be just as familiar with proteins, and for sure you will, because it's not any more complicated than that. Okay, so what is a nucleotide? Here is an illustration of a nucleotide made up of three different kinds of moieties. We have a base, an organic base. That just means that it can take hydrogen ions out of solution. It has different kinds of structures. Here's a sugar molecule. It happens to be a 5-carbon sugar. Remember, sugar molecules is just a linear chain of carbons with a H and an OH on either side, but they can bend back on each other and form this cyclic structure. So we've looked at the cyclic structure of 6-carbon sugars before. Here's just a 5-carbon sugar. So there's a group coming up over here, and then here is the third part of a nucleotide. This is just a phosphate group. All right, so the three things that make up a nucleotide are the phosphate is a phosphate group, the 5-carbon sugar, and the base. Let's talk about the sugar right here, the 5-carbon sugar. It can be a ribose sugar, or it can be a deoxyribose sugar. If it's a deoxyribose sugar, then it's going to participate in making DNA. And in DNA, these are the bases that we have. There's only four. There's guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. We usually don't say that. We just say GTCA for these compounds. They're going to have a little bit different structure. And even on this diagram, you can see that guanine, that G and A are large compared to T and C. T and C are a little bit smaller bases. So that gives you a relative size. So if we look at this illustration right here down on the bottom, notice that all of these nucleotides are joined together, right? And so how would your body put this G nucleotide together with this T nucleotide? What kind of reaction would it use? A dehydration synthesis reaction, right? All right, so when we look at this, we see that DNA is a long chain of molecules, or a long chain of nucleotides, just like a protein is a long chain of amino acids, just like glycogen is a long chain of monosaccharides. And we see that the bases all stick in one direction, and that the ribose or deoxyribose sugars are all joined together with this phosphate atom right here. Actually, it's a group. It's an inorganic phosphate group. Okay, so DNA contains deoxyribose. Still don't see it on the slide. And you see the four bases. And the sugar is going to be deoxyribose. That's, I think, all we need to say on this particular slide. But when we look at DNA, it's not going to be a single strand like this. It's going to be a double strand. DNA is always going to be a double-stranded molecule. And so there's going to be an association between the bases. And the bases will have to obey a certain base pairing rule. Here's the base pair rule. Guanine always base pairs with cytosine. And thymine always base pairs with adenine in DNA. So sometimes we call this GC, right, and AT. And I think on this slide you can appreciate that if you have a large base, if it's going to base pair just properly, there's got to be a small one over here so that it can fit together in a small space. You can't have two large bases that associate with each other. It won't fit. And if there's two small bases, then they don't get close enough together to form these hydrogen bonds. I don't want you to know the number of hydrogen bonds between GC and AT, but I think you should understand that it has to have the right shape. The molecules have to fit together, right? And if we have two different chains, one over here and one over here, what kind of bond holds the DNA chains together? And you see that on this slide. It's going to be hydrogen bond. Oh, is it labeled? It's not even labeled. Oh, yeah, but it says hydrogen bond. But you might want to just draw in. Here's a hydrogen bond. Okay. All right, so here is a better representation of what DNA looks like. We said it's double-stranded, right? So here I have one strand, and then over here I have the second strand. And so it's always going to be a phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar. on one side, and it's going to be a phosphate sugar on the other hand, on the other side, and the bases are going to point to the location where these different strands are joined together. If you look at this structure right here, it might remind you of something that you have around the house. Does it remind you of anything you have around the house? Guys will have an easier time looking at this. It looks like a ladder to me, okay? And a ladder has these two rungs or handholds over here, and then in the center, what do we have in the center of a ladder? The steps, right? So the steps are made out of the bases, right? And the handrails are made out of that repeating unit of phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar. And what kind of sugar molecule is this in DNA? It's a deoxyribose. I think on the next slide I'm going to show you that. So these strands will join together only if these base pair rules are obeyed. We call that the law of complementary base pairing, right? So G pairs with C and T pairs with A. And other thing that you're going to see is that in DNA you have thymine. That's going to be a nice landmark that you're looking at DNA. It will probably be easier to know this is DNA because it's double-stranded. That's going to be the first thing that jumps out at you. And if you have this primary sequence just right, it can form this twisting structure, right, that we call the double helix, almost similar to what we found in proteins, right? So it will twist up like that, and that's DNA for you. All right, let's look at some other nucleotides or some pieces of some other nucleotides. So here is deoxyribose. Here's that ribose sugar. You can uncycle it if you want to and look at the structure. But at this location, the ribose sugar would have an oxygen. But in DNA or deoxyribose, that oxygen is missing. All right, so this is one of the pieces that makes a DNA nucleotide. If we look over here on the right, that oxygen reappears. So this is just a regular old ribose sugar. This is the unit that's used to make an RNA nucleotide. One other little difference. Here is thymine, and this is a smaller kind of base. There is another one that's called uracil, and uracil almost looks the same as thymine, except for this methyl group right here, you just have a hydrogen atom in substitution. All right, so in RNA molecules, you have a ribose sugar and you have uracil. In DNA molecules or strands, we have deoxyribose and thymine. So in DNA, we'll see thymines and never uracil. If we're looking at RNA, we're going to see uracil and never a thymine. So again, that's a nice molecular way that you can tell the difference between RNA and DNA. The other thing is that RNA is single-stranded. DNA is double-stranded, so you should appreciate that. There might be certain segments where RNA can fold back on itself and form a double strand, but think of DNA double-stranded, RNA typically single-stranded. There are three kinds of RNA that is synthesized from DNA, and it allows the nucleus to control the physiology of the cell. The first one, let's talk about this first one right here, ribosomal RNA, little r, and then big R, capital N, capital A, ribosomal RNA. So it's used to make a structure inside the cell. What's the structure inside the cell that it makes? A ribosome. It makes a ribosome, hence that's what we name it. There are different kinds of subunits that come together, different subunits of rRNA that come together to make a ribosome. The important thing for us is to know that the ribosome is the workbench for making something. What does a ribosome make? I don't know if we talked about it in this class yet, but from anatomy, we went over it quite a bit. We know what a ribosome looks like, and it makes proteins, right? So the ribosome is the workbench where a protein is made, right? And in order to make a protein on that workbench, what does the ribosome need? Okay, what's the building block of a nucleic acid? It is a nucleotide, that's right. So nucleotides have to be brought to this ribosome, okay, in order to make a protein. We'll see how that goes. So here is a transfer RNA. Transfer RNA, right, is going to bring in the proper building blocks for a protein. A building block for protein is what? Amino acid. So this transfer RNA will bring amino acids into this ribosome so that they can be incorporated into a protein. So you could think of a transfer RNA as being a taxi RNA. Maybe that's another way of thinking about it. All right. Well, we have to put amino acids together in just the correct way to get a specific protein, right? It has to have the right primary structure. We call that just the sequence. And what determines the primary structure of a protein is the primary structure of this messenger RNA. If we change the sequence of nucleotides and messenger RNA, that's going to change, or there's a good chance it's going to change the primary structure of a protein. And what happens if you change the primary structure of a protein? Yeah, because you change the secondary structure, you change the tertiary structure, so now you're changing the shape of that protein, and when you change the structure of that protein, then the function might be changed. Right? We'll talk about some interesting examples of that. All right, so ribosomal RNA makes the workbench for making a protein. This transfer RNA brings in amino acids to the ribosome so that it can be incorporated into a protein. And the instructions for where these different amino acids are placed in a protein is carried by the messenger RNA. Sometimes we just call it the message. Right? It's like the dictionary and how to spell out a word, but it's a dictionary how to spell out a protein in terms of the amino acid letters. Right, so remember, if you change the spelling of a word, you change its meaning. If you change the sequence of amino acids in a protein, then you change its function. Wow, that's the last slide? Holy cow, that is true. Okay. All right, so I do want you to be able to recognize the difference between a deoxyribose and a ribose. And I think I have the sign-in sheet going around. Did I bring the sign-in sheet down for you guys? Good. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, deoxyribose. Deoxyribose. And the other is just a plain old ribose without missing any oxygens or anything. All right, so those are the four classical kinds of biological molecules that we have in our body. So, I'm going to end this show, and hopefully I have something that I want to show you really close by. You have this in Blackboard as well. So let's go to wherever my folder is. Ah, here's a shortcut to my folder. Nice. And this is what I'm looking for. I made a video out of this for you guys. All right, so I want you to look at this slide right here. And eventually I'm going to want you to be able to tell me what you see on this slide. But you don't see anything on this slide because it's a rest station, right? You can kind of rest your mind, take a breath in, relax a little bit. But the next slide, there is something that I want you to be able to tell me something about. Like this right here. I see a base, an organic base, and I see a sugar molecule, and I see a phosphate. And when I look at the sugar molecule, it has an oxygen just in this position. So what is this beast right here? Okay, it's a building block of RNA. I like that. Okay, so yeah, it's a building block of RNA. Yeah, so RNA, you're really good. You don't have to tell me what this is. I don't care so much about that. But yeah, it's a building block of RNA. What are the building blocks of nucleic acids once again? Nucleotide. So this is a ribonucleotide. It's not a deoxyribonucleotide, right? So this is a ribonucleotide, and that's the level that we're going to take it. You don't have to tell me exactly which one. But, oh, here's a great question. How many different possibilities could this be if we didn't know what this structure was? What kind of ribonucleotides do you have? Do you have like 20 of them? 30? 2? 4. You got 4. Right, and you should know their names and the base pair rules for that. All right, so there is what? Guanine, cytosine, okay, thymine, and uracil, right, not adenine. Okay. All right, so here is that ribonucleotide. That's all I want you to know about that, and that is the building block of a nucleic acid, and in particular, an RNA. All right, so we worked really hard on that one, so we get a little rest station right here. We get a break, okay? So you guys ready for the next one? Yeah. Hopefully I made this next one really fun and important. Ah, yeah, that's simple. What is this functional group right here? Sulfhydryl group. And I think you have a little appreciation of what this sulfhydryl group can do if it's on an amino acid. It can bend back and join another sulfhydryl group and make a covalent bond between different locations within a protein. That covalent bond is what? Strong or weak? It's really strong, so it's going to have a tendency to stabilize the three-dimensional structure of a protein. All right, but for this question, you could just say sulfhydryl group. That would be nice. And then we have a rest station, or I do. All right, ready for the next one? Yes. Ah, what's this? Amino group. That's going to be really important in what kind of building block? Building block for? Yeah, protein, right? So amino acid has this group right here, which allows a very nice peptide bond to be formed between the carboxyl group of another amino acid, and that's going to form a really nice stable bond. The peptide bond is really nice and stable. Aha, what's this? Carboxylic. Okay, and maybe what should you know about this? This hydrogen can jump off, which means this is, when you have a molecule that donates protons to a solution, it is an acid. Yeah, so here's an acid, carboxylic acid. All right, that's good. And another group right here, phosphate, inorganic phosphate. Right, and is that an acid or a base or is that a neutral kind of molecule? It's acid, right, because this proton can hop off and this one can hop off, and then you're just left with two electrical charges right here, but that's a phosphate group. ATP is going to have these things. It's going to have three of these things. ADP is going to have two. Right, and even phospholipid will have one of these things. So this inorganic phosphate is used a lot in different ways in our body. What is this? Okay, sugar. Oh, I like that. It's a sugar. A complex sugar or a simple sugar? Okay, and in this class we're going to call a simple sugar a what? Disaccharide, trisaccharide? Tried to trick you. It's just a monosaccharide. Right, and so this is just a monosaccharide. And can you tell if this thing will dissolve in water very easily or not? Yes, because here we have a hydrogen covalently bound to an oxygen, right, and so that forms a polar covalent bond, so this will dissolve in water. What happens if this were an S right here instead of an O? It would still dissolve in water, right, because that forms a polar covalent bond. If it's a nitrogen, or a phosphorus polar covalent bond, right? But if there's another C right here, it wouldn't happen. But if there was a C right here, then it would still become a nonpolar molecule because it's only phosphorus, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur in our world that make these polar covalent bonds. All right, I need a rest. But now I'm ready. What is this thing right here? It's a fatty acid, but what kind of fatty acid? A saturated fatty acid. Okay. Oh, what do we got happening here? Dehydration synthesis. And probably you should know these components. Like, what is this molecule here? Glycerol. What are these over here? Three fatty acids. And how many of them to make this compound over here? You need, somebody told me already, you need three. So that happens with the dehydration synthesis reaction. When this compound is produced, what do we call this thing? This is a triglyceride. Right, and you could go back the other way. We could flip this arrow around. It wouldn't mind. What would that reaction be called? Hydrolysis. Then you'd need three water molecules to break it up. Okay. So another rest station. What do we got here? Complex sugar, disaccharide. It is a monosaccharide. Yeah, I just want you to know that this kind of configuration here is a monosaccharide, and it can be put joined together with other monosaccharides with what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay. Ah, what is this cool little beast right here? Micelle. And I think you understand the physical chemistry of why it just forms all by itself spontaneously, because here is the polar head group of a phospholipid, and then here are the two fatty acid chains, which are nonpolar, so they don't want to have anything to do with water. That's why they all stick into the center of this micelle. And if we look at this micelle, it might remind you of a couple things. If it was straight, what would it remind you of? a membrane, right? But in water right here, it's going to form this circular structure, actually a spherical structure. So what would that really remind you of? A cell, right? So if you have that self-enclosing membrane, then you have this environment inside, different from the outside environment, and that's what can happen in a cell. What are these guys? These are all steroids. You don't have to tell me the name, but here is probably cholesterol, and then we have some derivations of cholesterol, like testosterone, estrogen, all right, and cortisol. I tried to put a couple hormones together. Okay. All right, so what do we got here? It's a fatty acid, but a different kind. It is unsaturated fatty acid. Nice. Here we got, you're really familiar with this guy. Maybe not your favorite molecule, but pretty easy to see. It's an amino acid, right? And it's just a generic amino acid because we'd have to substitute something in this R position to make it become a specific kind of amino acid, like a valine or isoleucine, glycine. You don't have to know them by structure, but this you should know by the structure, that it is an amino acid. Okay, your favorite molecule. You see it in two different configurations. You see it drawn out with its chemical formula. Over here is just more graphic representation. This is a phospholipid, right? So here's the polar head group. Here are the nonpolar tails, or these fatty acids sticking out over here. What's the interesting thing about this phospholipid? What can you tell me about this, the nature of a phospholipid? Does it like water or does it like lipid? It likes both, but depending on what end of the molecule you're talking about, right? All right, so a phospholipid can associate with water. If we have this phosphate group, it can also associate with nonpolar molecules or lipids because of the fatty acids. All right, so if I turn this figure upside down or backwards or give you another drawing, I change the drawing somehow, but I mean it's going to be exactly the same thing, but change it. Maybe I'll have the fatty acids pointing down over here. Will you be able to recognize that as a fatty acid? Yeah, because you can analyze the structure, right? You can say, oh, well, here's that phosphate group, here are the fatty acids. No matter which way it's pointing, you should be able to tell me that's a fatty acid. Okay, here we have some fatty acids that have been modified. What are these things? What are these things right here? These are important hormones in our body. These are prostaglandins. Where do we get prostaglandins from? Do we get them from cholesterol? Are these steroids? You would say no. They are lipids, right? They're derivations they come from fatty acids, right? The other steroids like estrogen, testosterone, etc., come from cholesterol. Prostaglandins don't come from cholesterol. They come from fatty acids. All right, so prostaglandins. And then here, what is this thing? I like it. Somebody said secondary structure. Yeah, secondary structure of a protein. And what determines the secondary structure? Yeah, the sequence of amino acids in a protein, which we call the primary structure. Okay, so secondary structure. I like that. What's this thing here? It's missing something. It's missing an oxygen. It's used to make a nucleic acid, right? What kind of nucleic acid is it used to make? Yeah, it's used to make a DNA. So what kind of nucleotide is this? This is a deoxyribonucleotide, right? It's a building block for DNA. Sweet. What's next here? Go ahead, tell me. I'm going to stop telling you all this. Now you got to tell me. Or we're going to be stuck on this slide all weekend. And we don't want to do that. You want to tell me what this is? This is a hydroxyl group, then a rest station. What is this right here? Oh, you got to know this one. You should probably be able to draw this out. This is glycerol, right? 3-carbon unit right here. And then we have a carbonyl group. Here is, I think, where we started pretty much. This is, okay. Yeah, this is a ribonucleotide, not a deoxyribonucleotide. All right, so when I show you these slides, tell me what you see very quickly. Just name what you see. Okay, so we saw a bunch of chemicals at the moment. Let's look at them again. What is this thing here? A ribonucleotide. All right, so now let's look at the next picture. So you can't look at me because I'm going to flash it past your eyes and you got to tell me what it is. What is that? Sulfhydro group. Okay, did everybody know that before lecture today? I don't know, maybe not, but I think afterwards you should probably know. And what is this right here? Amino group. What is that? Carboxyl group. And you should appreciate other things about that carboxyl group, like it's an acid, for instance. Here's a phosphate group. Don't know what happened there. And then what do we got? You saw it already. Monosaccharide. Don't have to tell me which one. And then saturated fatty acid. And what do we got right here? Triglyceride formation via a dehydration synthesis reaction. What's that right there? Monosaccharide. What's this? Micelle. You should know what the building block of a micelle is. What is it? Oh, what is it? It is a phospholipid, right? And so you should know something about those components of a phospholipid. And while I was talking, I showed you steroids, right? The one on top was cholesterol, so steroids are derived from cholesterol. There is a nice unsaturated fatty acid. Here we have nice amino acid. And then here we have your favorite molecule, phospholipid. I could show you this, or I could show you that, for instance. Okay, what is this right here? Prostaglandins derived from fatty acids. Here is secondary structure. Secondary structure is a building block of what? Secondary structure is a building block of tertiary structure. What's the building block of secondary structure? That's primary structure, yeah. So I deliberately tricked you on that one. Okay, what's that right there? Deoxyribonucleotide. Deoxyribonucleotide. Here is hydroxyl group, glycerol. I can't remember if this is the second or first time through. Glycerol. What do we have here? Carbonyl group. That's a ribonucleotide. It's just a regular old ribo sugar, right? So ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Nice. Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride formation, dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, so we covered this already. So I'm just going to pick up the pace just a little bit. Okay, so watch the screen, don't blink. All right, and then tell me, too bad I can't make a test out of this. Maybe later on in the semester, a video test. All right, what's that? Monosaccharide. What's that? Micelle. Steroids. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. Prostaglandins. Secondary structure. Make sure you can go up and down. Deoxyribonucleotide. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Make sure you know that glycerol molecule. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide, that's a building block for RNA, right? It's a building block for nucleic acid, in particular RNA. Sulfhydryl group, amino group, carboxyl group, phosphate group, monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid, triglyceride formation, monosaccharide, micelle, steroid, unsaturated fatty acid, amino acid, phospholipid. I bet you didn't think you could just see that molecule before class if you'd looked at it for just a couple milliseconds. But that's nice. That's impressive. What's that? Prostaglandin. Secondary structure. Deoxyribonucleotide. Deoxyribonucleotide, a little bit harder to analyze quickly. That was easy. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. My fingers slowed down. Okay, carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl group. Okay, so I do have a video someplace. It's either in Blackboard or my website. And it just shows you these molecules kind of slow the first time, and then it speeds it up, so it just flashes at you. And I think, I'm not so sure, but I think every once in a while I did it so fast that the video couldn't capture that frame. But I think maybe I have all the molecules right there, okay? Because I didn't want to make the frame rate really high because it would have been a really huge video that way. But you have these pictures in Blackboard and also that video. Okay, so that was a flash quiz, right there. Okay. All right, so anybody got a question about chemistry? Those different kinds of molecules? And, oh, I guess I do have a quick question for you. All right, where was that? Over here. All right, so here's the difference between RNA and DNA. All right, the deoxyribose sugar compared to a ribose sugar. Does that impress you as a large structural change or a small structural change? All right, so a small structural change in a molecule can result in what? A huge difference in its behavior inside the cell. Right? Even though it's a small change in structure, you would expect that the function does change, but even a small change can make a big change in how the molecule works inside the cell. Like this deoxyribose, where would you never find this deoxyribose nucleotide? You would never find... Or if we put it together to make a nucleic acid out of it, where would we never find this? We would never find it. Never find it in certain location inside the cell. You would never find it outside the nucleus, right? You could call that cytoplasm. It's always going to be stuck inside the nucleus just because it's missing this little oxygen atom right there. Okay, so that, I think, is kind of impressive. All right, we're ready to move on to the next chapter. Got any notes for that? I didn't ask you to do the pre-lecture reading assignment for this one because we're just a little bit ahead of schedule. And the answer key won't open up until next week. But nonetheless, let's get started with it. It is chapter 6. Pointer options, arrow options, visible interactions between cells and the extracellular environment. What's extracellular environment? Where do you find the extracellular environment? Outside of cells. Intracellular environment is all the stuff inside cells, right? So extracellular environment you might want to think of as like a non-living place. So just like we wanted to know some physical chemistry, especially with regard to that phospholipid molecule, we're going to study some more physical chemistry in here, and that is, how do you move molecules around from one place to another? All right, so let's talk about the extracellular environment a little bit first, right? It includes all the constituents of the body outside of cells. And most of that, okay, is going to be water. Right? So let's think about what's inside the cell. The intracellular compartment, right, makes up about 67% of total body water, right? And that's inside cells, which means all the other water is in the extracellular spaces, like in plasma, right, in other kinds of ground substances and connective tissues. Right, and even in some tissue spaces that's not in connective tissue, but just between cells. Right, and that extracellular compartment, right, is going to be 33%, right, outside of cells. 80% of that extracellular fluid is interstitial fluid. Right, it's contained in that jelly-like material in a matrix of connective tissue. Remember, we call that ground substance from anatomy. And 20% of that extracellular fluid is in blood plasma. And you could actually think of blood plasma, which is the fluid part of blood, you could actually make a really nice case that that really still is the ground substance in blood, because what kind of tissue is blood? It's a connective tissue, right? And if you go outside of a cell in a connective tissue, then that's just ground substance. But this is kind of a funny ground substance because it is a fluid. It can flow. So I think that's why your book separates it out a little bit. All right, so what's the take-home message right here? That your body is dissolved in water, right? Yeah, we're a water system. We're a water solution of various kinds of chemicals. And you see where some of these water compartments are. So if something is dissolved in water, it can actually move around. It can move by flow, it could move by diffusion. But if there's a compound in a solid structure like bone, then it can't move around. It's stuck, right? So it's got to be in a fluid, and that fluid is water. So here we see, a space right here with nothing in it. And then I see a layer of cells, and then I see like a little line coming right here, and then underneath that I see a whole bunch of stuff. So you should be able to tell me what kind of tissue this is that I have the arrow on right now. That is a epithelium. Should be able to classify very nicely as a simple, and it could be squamous, could be cuboidal, because we just don't see enough angles. But I'll just call it a cuboidal, simple cuboidal epithelium. Then underneath we have the basement membrane. Basement membrane attaches it to other structures underneath, deep to the epithelium. And that could be connective tissue, could be bone, could be blood vessels, nerves, right? And in this particular slide, right, I basically just see other connective tissue. So that extracellular matrix made up of collagen and elastic fibers up over in this region right here are linked to molecules of the ground substance and also to the plasma membrane. And some of those proteins are what we call integrins that stick off of the plasma membrane on these epithelial cells, and that helps link these cells right here, or it just stabilizes the interaction between this epithelium and the connective tissue underneath, right? So it just doesn't fall off. Interstitial fluid, right, resides in that hydrated gel around all of these cells, right? And that jelly-like material is proteoglycan. So it is part of the four molecules that we looked at in the previous chapter. Proteoglycan. What kind of molecule is a proteoglycan? But it is part protein, okay? And this glycan right here just means sugar, right? So it's a protein sugar kind of molecule, all right? And where do these protein sugar molecules come from? What can make a protein in your body? A ribosome can, okay? And so it makes a protein, but this is not just a protein. This is a protein modified with a sugar molecule. What organelle can take a protein and modify it, can conjugate it with a sugar molecule? You guys learned this in anatomy, and we're going to get to that a little bit later on, but it is the Golgi body, Golgi apparatus, right? Golgi apparatus gets proteins from another organelle, modifies it, packages it into a vesicle, and then ships it outside of the cell. We call that a secretory pathway. All right, so let's go back. Where does the Golgi body get those proteins from? What's the organelle that Golgi body gets proteins from? It is the rough endoplasmic reticulum, because rough ER has, what does it have that makes it look rough? It has those ribosomes, right, which makes a protein. It makes that protein, gets secreted into inside the cisternae of the endoplasmic reticulum, and then those proteins are always behind the membrane somehow. All right, so that's one particular fate of a protein, is that it's trapped in a vesicle or it's secreted outside if it's made by rough ER. But a protein can have another fate if it's made by ribosome someplace else. So let's see if we can recall what that is. Where else can we find ribosomes besides on rough endoplasmic reticulum? Just floating around in the cytosol. Yeah, just cytosolic ribosomes. And when they make a protein, where do those proteins end up? Just right in the cytosol. They stay inside the cell. They're never secreted, right? So there's two possible fates for a protein depending on where it's made. If it's a free ribosome, stays inside the cell. If it's a ribosome associated with endoplasmic reticulum, then it's going to be inside of a vesicle or it's going to be secreted outside the cell. But a free ribosome never makes a protein that is secreted from the cell. That has to be rough endoplasmic reticulum only. Okay. I think that's all I want to say about this slide. We could talk a lot about that slide, but that's good enough for now. Okay, transport across a plasma membrane. And can anybody remember, how do we want to think about a plasma membrane? Let's start with the simple thing first. What's the building block of a plasma membrane? Okay, I drew it in that little salad dressing bottle. Is what? A phospholipid molecule. Right. And as a matter of fact, if you think about a living membrane, it's just not one phospholipid molecule. It's a bunch of them all lined up that makes a layer, and that's still not the ultimate case. Right. A living membrane is made up of two layers of those phospholipids, so we think of that as the phospholipid bilayer. Right. But that's still not a very mature way of thinking of a membrane. What's the best way to think about a membrane? Phospholipid bilayer plus other stuff added to it, like proteins or sugar molecules. So we'd like to think of a membrane with a fluid mosaic model. Fluid is the phospholipid bilayer. The mosaic part are all the other kinds of things that can be put into the membrane. Proteins, that could be channels, right, or enzymes, or identity markers, or pores. So that is the mosaic part of the phospholipid bilayer. So if we have a phospholipid bilayer, what is the nature, what's the physical chemistry of the innermost part of the phospholipid bilayer? Is it polar or nonpolar? Right, is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It is nonpolar, right? It's made with those fatty acids. And so things that are polar, like water or salt, they can't get across the membrane because they can't get across that nonpolar region of the plasma membrane. So many important molecules have transporters or channels that allow them to move across the cell membrane. All right. We got carrier-mediated transport, involves a specific protein as a transporter. Right. A non-carrier-mediated transport occurs by diffusion, maybe through membrane channels. So things, molecules that are polar need to be carried across, or they have to have a pore or channel through the membrane so that they can move across the cell membrane. And we are only talking about molecules that can dissolve in water, which are polar compounds, bless you, polar compounds, or hydrophilic compounds. Because hydrophobic compounds can diffuse, right? If they can move right across the membrane, they're not excluded from the inside of the cell because they can move right through that nonpolar region inside the plasma membrane. All right, so let's look at some transport mechanisms. We can break them down into two nice categories, passive versus active transport. Right? And passive transport, good way to think of that is it does not require energy. It's a process that will happen all by itself without any extra input of energy. Active transport will require energy of some kind. And you're going to see that there is a primary kind of active transport. And take a guess what molecule is the energy molecule that allows for active transport. It is your favorite energy molecule. It is ATP. Yep. So active transport is going to involve ATP, at least the primary kind. All right, so let's go back to this passive transport. ATP is not necessary, right, for active transport. Then a molecule will move from an area of high concentration to low concentration. And so if we were to draw a graph of concentration of a molecule over space, right, then you would have a line that goes up like a wedge, and so we call that a gradient. Think of that as like being a hill. And molecules will move from high concentration to low concentration and requires no energy. That's a passive process. You have a picture in your mind of how that works? I wish I had my markers down here. Can you see that? Sure. All right, I'm going to erase free from the board. Maybe I'll turn a light on really quick. All right, so if you don't see this, it will make life a little bit difficult for you. All right, what an active and passive process is in terms of this gradient. All right, so if we have concentration of some kind of molecule, and we're going to plot that over some kind of distance over here, and we make a nice straight line, what can you tell me about the concentration of X as you change position someplace? Okay? If we just look at this line. So here we have the concentration of a molecule. Here we have, let's say, 10. The concentration is 10 over here. We move away from that location over here. What's the concentration? It's going to be 10. And if we move over here, what's the concentration? It's going to be 10. And over here, it's going to be 10. So does this line, is it going up or going down? No, it's flat. Okay. But let's just say the concentration changes. So let's just say it's 5 over here and 15 over here. And as we move along a room or something, we see that the concentration is what? Increasing or decreasing? It's increasing.
All right, so to somebody, this thing right here kind of looks like a hill, right? Going down the hill, going up the hill. So we call this a gradient, right? That incline right there is a gradient. You could use that word incline if you wanted to. All right, so let's just put this into a nice real-world circumstance. So here we have something like this. Nice little steering wheel right there. That is my little car that I had when I was in college. It was an MGB. Anybody know what an MGB is? Maybe, but they've all dissolved away by now, so you don't see them anymore. And when I was in college, this little car, sometimes the starter motor was bad, the little starter electric motor. Sometimes the battery was dead. Sometimes the key didn't work, right? So I couldn't get the car started with the key, which was no problem because this was a manual transmission. So what could I do? Yeah, I could just kickstart it. I just put my leg outside the car, put it in neutral, get the car rolling down a hill, and as I was rolling down the hill, I'd pop the clutch, and then the engine would start. Okay? All right, so would my car roll down this hill in this direction without any energy? Or would I need gasoline?
No.
So going from high to low is what? Passive? That just happens all by itself. My car would do that. Molecules will do that in your body. They will move from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration. Now, what about going up the hill? Did that require energy?
Yes.
That's what we call an active process. Of course, in my car, it would need gasoline to go up, to go from low to high. So molecules going from low concentration to high concentration requires energy if it's just a molecule. And what's our favorite form of energy? What molecule? ATP. Yeah, it's not a car. Active, right, is going to use ATP. All right, so when we say gradient, you have a sense of what a gradient means? It just means in one area there's very few molecules, in another area there are a lot of those molecules. The concentration is very high. So just think of my car. Don't ever get that wrong on a test. Okay, high to low, low to high. Okay, so one is passive. Which way do molecules move for a passive transport? High to low. Yeah, they're going to move down the concentration gradient. If it's active process, which way do they go? Low to high. And it goes against the concentration gradient, right? Just like my car right there. Okay. All right, so let's work on some definitions first. Like, what is a solution? Right? Not a solution to a physics problem or a math problem, something like that, but in terms of chemistry, a solution has two compartments, two components. And these components are the solvent, that's the fluid part of a solution, and it has solutes. This is the solid particles that you put into that solvent and they dissolve. All right, so have you used a solvent today? Have you used one? So you could say yes or no.
Yes.
I would say most people would say yes. Okay. What solutes have you used today? Right, if you've used a solution, right, what solutes have you used today? Have you used any sugar? Mm-hmm. Solute is that solid particle you put into the solvent to make it dissolve. Probably maybe you've used sugar. Maybe a little sodium. Let's think of a nice solution. How about coffee? Coffee is a nice solution. It has water, right? So the solvent is water. What's the solute? The coffee particles, yeah. All right. And then if you put sugar in there, that becomes a solute. Other things you put in there. I don't know of anybody that puts salt in there, but I suppose it's possible.
No.
Milk. Yeah, you put milk in there, that would be the solute. But milk is a solution too, so there are particles in milk. And in us, what is the major solvent in your body?
Water.
Water. Yeah. What are some important solutes that are in your body?
Sodium
ions. Potassium ions. I hear sugar. I like sugar. Right? Amino acids. Nucleic acids. Nucleotides. These are all the parts that make up a solution inside your body. Right? So what are the important solutes in your body? Nice. But the major solvent is water. What is a minor solvent in your body? Okay, this is strange, but it's really nice to think about this. We'll talk about this later in the class. So we have water, but what's another solvent
that's in your body.
Yes.
Okay? And, well, blood is mostly made out of water. Yeah, so that's mostly a water system. Okay? The minor solvent system in your body is lipid. And what kind of molecules like to dissolve in lipid? Hydrophobic molecules. We don't have a lot of lipid in our bodies. You find the lipid where? Right on the inside of the plasma membrane. It's a really small space, but it's going to be really important because certain molecules will want to exist in that space only. Right. So what can dissolve in this minor solvent, the lipid part? Looking, sugars can't because they're polar. Sodium, potassium can't. What can dissolve in with all those fatty acids right there? What kind of molecule is a fatty acid? It is, what is a sugar, a lipid, carbohydrate, well, is it protein, sugar, lipid, or nucleic acid? It's a lipid, so any kind of lipid molecule can dissolve in that, in the center of the plasma membrane. What about steroids? Are they a lipid? Yeah, so steroids can dissolve in that inner component of a membrane. And in us, we do use cholesterol in that area to make the membrane a little bit stronger. But there's other kinds of important physiologic signaling molecules that little environment is going to be important for. And so just think that our body can be considered partly water world of all these nonpolar compounds, including water, but it's also lipid world. And things happen in that lipid compartment that are really important, even though it's so small. It's really minuscule compared to water world in your body. So right now, we're just going to talk about water world. Here we have a beaker, right? And we have water, so we have water in here. We got some kind of solute in this system. So this is, here we have water with a solute. So what is this really right here? This is a solution, right, because it's got those two compartments, and it's separation. There's a little separation over here, and on the left-hand side we have a lot of solute. We say it's high concentration of that solute, and over here we have very little of it. If it was sugar, it would taste really sweet. If you sampled it over here, you might not taste any sweetness if you sample it over here because the concentration is lower. Right, so diffusion. What is diffusion? It is a passive process. So which way are these molecules going to move? Always from high to low, right? And it's easy to see that these molecules are going to move from high concentration to low concentration because it's a passive process. Diffusion is passive. And then this molecule is going to move without energy until there are equal concentrations on either side of this little dotted line right here. Right? When the concentrations are equal, what happens to diffusion? Because what did we say about diffusion? Passive process, something moves from high to low. All right, so what's higher, the one on the left or the one on the right? What's higher? They're equal, right? So there is no net diffusion. There might be some molecules that move over here, but it's going to be the same number that move over there, right? So that is diffusion. Another way of thinking about this, I got a trick question for you. Before we go away for the weekend, I'm going to open up a perfume bottle right here. I'm going to set it down on the table. That perfume is going to evaporate into the air. And there's going to be a high concentration of perfume right here. Who would smell that perfume first? First row, second row, third row. And is it going to move to the back of the room? Yes, because of that concentration gradient. High concentration here, low concentration there. We're going to leave that bottle open all weekend. We're going to come in the room and walk into the room. And we're going to smell perfume in the back, right? And what happens to diffusion then? It's going to have the same concentration of perfume up there compared to here. So what happens to diffusion of perfume at that particular time? It stops because there's no concentration gradient, right? Okay. We're not going to do that experiment, actually, but it's a little thinking experiment that you should be aware of. All right, so we're still talking about diffusion. Nonpolar compounds readily diffuse through the cell membrane. Nonpolar, meaning hydrophobic compounds. Not hydrophilic compounds. Water is, of course, hydrophilic. Can't diffuse right through a cell membrane, right? But nonpolar compounds can. Oxygen, CO2 are pretty good examples of some compounds that you could think of as being nonpolar. They can diffuse through a membrane very easily, right?
So gas exchange occurs by diffusion. Oxygen, of course, you know, is a really important molecule that keeps us alive. The way that it moves around in our body is just automatic, right? It requires no energy. So let's take a look at oxygen. So here is oxygen moving into the cell. And so where is oxygen? If oxygen is moving into the cell, where is it at high concentration? Is it high in the air or is it high inside the cell? It's got to be high in the air. Even though you need high concentration of oxygen in that cell to keep it alive, it still has to be higher in the air. Otherwise, it wouldn't diffuse into the cell because things only move from high concentration to low. So it's maybe a little bit strange kind of concept. CO2 is pretty toxic. Right, so a cell produces CO2, and it's going to move into the air, which means where is CO2 at a high concentration? It's got to be high inside the cell, low outside, so that it can move by diffusion. And I just noticed that we got different colored dots right here, huh? Okay. You could probably understand what these little dots mean, but I have no idea. Okay, so even though CO2 can be toxic inside a cell, it will just move out because that's where the concentration is high. And in the air, it's low, it's almost like zero in the air. So there's a big concentration gradient, a big concentration difference. And as a matter of fact, the rate of diffusion depends on the magnitude of that concentration gradient. So if the big concentration gradient, like high inside the cell, almost zero outside, then CO2 will move very rapidly, because the concentration gradient is very big. If the concentration is almost the same, right, then the rate of diffusion slows down. And as they become the same, then diffusion stops. Okay. All right, so that's a passive process. What else do we have? Still talking about diffusion. So what do we have right here? What I'm circling? This is the phospholipid. You see some phospholipids? Phospholipid bilayer. That's a really nice, simple way to think of a membrane. But what else do we have? We have some proteins embedded in this phospholipid bilayer. So we see what? A nice fluid mosaic of a membrane. And then we have one other molecule. We have some ions, right? And these ions are what? Are they hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Do they love water, hate water? You know they love water because you could put almost as much salt as you wanted into a glass of water and it would dissolve in there, right? So they are hydrophilic, which means that they are polar. And remember, the inner part of this membrane right here is nonpolar, right? So these ions right here don't want to have anything to do with this nonpolar region of a cell. So they can't diffuse across it because they want to stay out of it. So that's really the beauty of this membrane, is that it separates out these two different worlds just by, okay, that physical chemistry. Very simple. But let's look at these particles. Where is this ion at a high concentration? Okay, so what do we got? We got extracellular fluid and intracellular fluid, so let's use those terms. Where is this ion at a high concentration? Extracellular fluid, and we can tell it's at high concentration compared to the intracellular fluid because you just see less particles right there. So which way is this molecule going to want to go? Will it want to go anywhere? Yeah, it will want to go from high concentration to low, but it can't get through the cell membrane, so it can't, right? So here is a special protein. This is what we call a channel. Channels sometimes can be open, they can be closed. In this particular case, the channel is closed, so there can be no diffusion across the membrane. But if something tells this channel to open, now this ion can move into the cell just by diffusion without requiring any ATP. All right, so sometimes we might want to call this a gated channel because it can open and close. And some of these ions that we're going to look at, the important ones are sodium and potassium, and calcium are probably the biggest three ions. Right, so they must, in order for this charged particle to move through or this ion to move through, it has to have an ion channel or a transporter that moves it across. Maybe that's the next slide. Okay, not the next slide. All right, let's just characterize diffusion completely here. The rate of diffusion, that means how fast diffusion is occurring, right, is determined by these things, the magnitude of the concentration gradient. As the gradient gets larger, the rate increases, and as the concentration gradient decreases to zero, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It decreases and then finally stops. right? The permeability of the membrane to it. All right, so on the previous case, the membrane is impermeable to this ion. It can't get across. No matter what concentration we put over here, super, super high, still can't get across the membrane. There's got to be a way for it to get across, right? So we call that the permeability. Also, temperature. As temperature increases, the rate of diffusion increases. Right, so let's think of in terms of a little mathematical concept. Is temperature directly related or inversely related to the rate of diffusion? It is directly related, right? So you have an equal sign, they're both in the numerator. We're going to use that term a lot. How about if it went the other way? If we increase temperature, the rate of diffusion stopped. What would the relationship be there then? Inverse relationship. Nice, okay. Surface area of the membrane. The surface area I want you to think of as a doorway. As we make the doorway bigger, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases as well. Think of this doorway over here. Keep it that size. Maybe we could get about 3 people through there at a time, maybe 4 if they got a running start. But if we made that doorway bigger, we could get a lot more than just 3 people at one time through there. That's a surface area. Increase the surface area, the rate of diffusion increases. So it is directly related. So all of these things over here are, oh, darn, look at that. It says right there. I didn't realize that. All of these things are directly related. We got one other kind of thing, the molecular weight. Right, molecular weight is just how big and how heavy that molecule is. And what's the relationship between molecular weight and the rate of diffusion? That's what caught my eye. It's inversely related. So as a molecule gets bigger and heavier, right, then it's just slower. Less diffusion there is. Right? So I don't think that's a really hard concept. One way to think of that is, say you have a motorcycle and you're at a stoplight and you're right next to a big truck, a semi-tractor truck, right? It's got the tractor and a big trailer behind it. And the light turns green. Who's going to get across the intersection first? A motorcycle, because it's lighter, right? So same thing for diffusion. Okay. Say that again. What? Oh, these are upside down over here. Yeah, there are answers to a question, and it's for my purpose only. I don't want to just be able to read the answer off the slide. I want to be able to think about it. Okay. All right. So here's something special. This is osmosis. Okay. And osmosis is diffusion, which means what? Requires energy or does not require energy? Osmosis is diffusion. It is passive. It is passive, so it does not require energy, right? And so what does that mean? Molecules can only move from high to low if it's osmosis, right? So we're going to discuss these three things. What are the three necessary criteria for a process to be considered osmosis? We just kind of described one thing already. It's diffusion, which is passive, requiring no energy. But there's got to be two other kinds of things. All right, so here we see a chemical system. And we have some particles in water, and I see some solutes over here. I don't see water molecules in this top chamber, so let's zoom in to this region right here. And we see a compartment on the left and on the right. And which compartment has more solute? Which one has more solute? The one on the right, okay? Less solute on the left. So which way is this solute molecule going to want to move? It's going to want to go from right to left, right? It's going to want to go from right to left because that's down its concentration gradient. All right, these little circles right here, I'll guess, they're blue. Are they blue? Yeah, okay. These little blue represent water. And as we increase the solute concentration, what happens to the concentration of water? It goes down. Right, so as we increase the percentage of particles, solute particles, the percentage of water just has to decrease, right? Because if we add them all together, they have to equal 100%. If one goes up, the other has to go down. All right, so where is water at a high concentration? Is it on the left or on the right? Yeah, so they're not equal. Water is much higher on the left, so water will want to move by diffusion down the concentration gradient through this little membrane right here. And so if we set the system up and let it go, will this water molecule move from left to right without energy? High concentration to low.
And the answer is, look at this arrow right here. This water molecule is small enough to where it can get through this little pore, this little hole, and we're going to call this a membrane. It can get through the membrane because it is small enough. And it's going to, when is this diffusion going to stop? When there's equal concentration of these water particles on either side of the membrane. All right, now what about the solute? It's going to want to go from right to left, right, from high concentration to low, but can it do that? No, because these pores are not big enough, right? So that's what we call the permeability of this solute molecule is zero. So the rate of diffusion is going to be zero because it can't even get through the membrane. All right, so what are we looking at here? Here we have a water molecule. Is that a solvent molecule or a solute molecule? It is the solvent molecule. Yes, yeah, solvent molecule. And is it moving by diffusion, just high to low?
Yes.
Okay. Well, in order for something to be osmosis, it has to be passive, which we have right here, and it has to be the solvent molecule, and only the solvent molecule when we talk about it. And in us, what is that solvent molecule? It's water, so that makes it simple. It doesn't have to be water, but in us it's going to be water. And the third criteria is that it has to move through this membrane. And this is a special membrane. Why is this a special membrane? It's semi-permeable. It lets some things through, but not everything, right? So that's what osmosis is. It's the diffusion of water through a selectively permeable membrane. That's it in just one sentence, but it's kind of a loaded sentence because when you say diffusion, you got to know what that means. What, high to low? No energy. Selectively permeable? Some things can go through, can't go through. The water molecule is easy to understand. That's just a solvent molecule. So that's osmosis. So is osmosis taking place here? In this?
Yes.
Yeah, because it's water going down concentration gradient through this selectively permeable membrane. Okay, these solutes over here, we say are osmotically active because they can't get through the cell membrane. Let's just see what would happen if they could get through the cell membrane. We put a big pore right here. Would they move across the membrane? If we put a really big hole right here, they would go from right to left because they could get through that hole, right? And so they would have the same concentration, and that would happen just by diffusion, but they can't get across. So a lot more water molecules move across this membrane, right, to make the concentration the same. What we mean by osmotically active, we will have a net diffusion of water from left to right into this compartment over here, because these particles can't move across. So what's going to happen to the amount of solution across this membrane if we wait a little while? As water molecules move in, right, they leave this one, enter the one on the right, what happens to the volume of these two chambers? It has to change. This one has to go down because water is leaving. This side over here, the volume has to increase because water is moving into it. All right, so this is like sucking water into this compartment over here. That's what we mean by osmotically active particles, right? It can change the volume across this membrane because this solute molecule can't move across, right? And if it can't move across, we say it's osmotically active. It's going to draw more water over to the right, and the volume of this chamber is going to get bigger. I might have to mention that again, but be sure to ask me if you have a question, and we're not done talking about, we're going to review that with this illustration when we start next week. Okay. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign that. I'll turn the light on.